From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, we'll talk about cybersecurity and internet-connected devices, from your fitness tracker to your car.
Later, we'll get an update on a wide-scale effort to improve the health of people living in Dodge County.
We're seeing people come together, and people who are really fired up about making positive changes and seeing the communities all change.
Plus, a couple of interviews on why bees need cities and cities need bees.
In reality, even though you wouldn't assume it, our urban areas and our cities have more biodiversity and are more abundant and offer a more diverse diet for the bees than you'd think.
In the inner city, there are less people pouring chemicals on things. There's less Chemlon. So my hives that are inside of the city are the best hives I have.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Think about all the things you have that connect to the internet. Your smartphone, your computer, obviously. But then there's the fitness tracker on your wrist, or the app in your car that lets you check whether you've locked the doors, or maybe it's your TV set.
It's the Internet of Things, or IoT, and it's changed the way many of us live, but it's also exposed us in new ways to hackers and other people who might seek to do us harm. How safe are we in the IoT landscape? It's a question Jen Rathburn wrestles with quite a bit. She's a partner at Foley & Lardner and co-founder of the Midwest Cybersecurity Alliance, and she's with us in the studio now. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back.
So the Internet of Things has grown exponentially in recent years. Consumers have more and more internet-enabled devices in their homes and in their pockets, and businesses are using more of these as well. Let me start with a really simple and maybe obvious question. For every internet-enabled device, should we assume that there is someone out there working to exploit its vulnerabilities?
Most definitely, yes. In fact, at a lot of the large hacker conferences, such as DEF CON and Black Hat, many of those security researchers actually, have sessions on how you can exploit those types of devices. And yes, unfortunately, those devices, bring risk not only to consumers who use them, but businesses who purchase them.
I would be lying if I didn't say, as I was preparing for this interview, I was glancing at the Fitbit on my wrist and, thinking about the kinds of data that it collects and what someone might want to do with that data.
Exactly. I think one of the biggest issues with internet-connected devices is really consumer understanding about what data is being collected and how is that data being used. I mean, oftentimes, when we allow someone to use our data through a connected device such as a Fitbit or others, we think, okay, well, they're using that data in order to provide us a service. But in fact, oftentimes there are secondary purposes in which the companies are using that for. And so that's one of the things that is evolving in this space. And, the FTC follows this because they have the responsibility for consumer protection, and the FTC has lots of recommendations. But essentially, it's, how transparent are companies being with consumers about what types of data are they collecting and for what purposes are they using that data, and what consumers, what consumer rights do consumers have to control that use of data?
Right. One of the distinctions that I was reading about is this idea that often you see that such and such a company will never sell your data to a third party. But that in itself doesn't necessarily mean they aren't sharing that data in some way, right?
Yes. It's also the age of big data. In addition to all of these devices being interconnected, companies are really focusing in on big data. And so the question is, okay, well, yes, you're collecting my data, and maybe you're not selling my data that's fully identifiable to a third party, but maybe that company is getting rights in that privacy notice to aggregate data or de-identify data. And, one of the things, though, I would say that gets very confusing, and I work with a lot of companies on developing privacy notices, sometimes it's difficult for companies to predict how they're going to use data 5 years in the future, even 6 months from now. And so I would say that for both companies and consumers is really looking at that privacy notice. What are you putting out there? Are you being transparent? And the FTC is watching those privacy notices as well. Oftentimes, if there is a breach of information, a security incident, a hack, you know, the FTC will look at, well, what kind of privacy notice did you provide to consumers? Did you, you know, promise that the security of their information would be protected, you know, in what manner?
You mentioned these privacy notices, and you know, they are often when we sign up for something online, we'll have to check that we've read and understand the privacy notices that they've provided for us. And realistically, a lot of us just click that box and go on with our lives. These privacy notices are not always written in such a way that's really easy for people. I would imagine even people who know the field to understand.
Yes, and that is one of the things that the FTC is trying to work on and give guidance to companies. I mean, consumers do have responsibility. You can't just say, well, I clicked on it. I have no responsibility. I don't know what happened. But that is definitely a problem. I mean, those consumer privacy notices, if you make them too complicated and consumers don't understand, then really, they're not useful in the end anyway. But that is the tug and pull in the space about what are consumers' responsibility and what are, you know, companies' responsibility with regard to providing consumers information about what they're doing with their data.
And I know you are not a computer engineer here, but one of the issues that I have read about in terms of security vulnerabilities that's apparently most common is, say, firmware that's not updated frequently enough. Where do things, in your experience, go wrong the most often?
Well, I think where things go the most wrong are when companies develop a device, they don't take security by design into consideration. And oftentimes, especially with startup companies or other things, they're just trying to take a product to market. And they're not thinking about, okay, well, this is a great product. It does all these wonderful things. There's all these benefits to business and consumers. But they don't think about, you know, what types of security vulnerabilities are in those products. How are we going to update and patch those products after, you know, their purchase? How long would we continue to do that? And what's so interesting about that is we have seen the Senate proposed a bill August 1st. It's called the Internet of Things Cybersecurity Improvement Act of 2017. And what's really interesting about this bill is, I mean, it's the first effort and push to try to protect internet-connected devices. And what this bill would require is that manufacturers that are selling IoT devices to government to, you know, implement certain security controls and think about things such as what you just mentioned. What are the security vulnerabilities? Are you going to be able to patch that device, you know, not using hard-coded passwords, you know, among other things? And really what we see in the legal space is oftentimes there are bills passed that affect government entities at first, but then those become standards that are pushed down to, you know, the private industry.
But again, this is where consumer responsibility comes into the picture as well. When a firmware update or a patch is available, there is some requirement on us as consumers to update it.
Yes, and that's where the FTC comes in. The FTC actually issued comments on the process aimed to improve the security of the Internet of Things back in June. And really what this was is a discussion about what should manufacturers tell consumers and what are consumer responsibilities. So, you know, one of the things they recommend to manufacturers, again, this is just guidance, it's not law, but when you see what the FTC comes out with guidance, manufacturers should take that into consideration because you know that if there's a issue down the road, these are the types of standards that the FTC is going to look at. And one of the things is, you know, does the device, can they receive security updates after it's purchased? You know, how will the consumer receive those security updates? And, you know, when will support of this device end? And I think that there is that pull and tug between, yes, manufacturer, you have to do security by design. You need to think about security vulnerabilities. You need to think of ways in which that device needs to be patched. But you also, consumer, we're not here to protect you for the rest of your life of this device. You know, you need to understand when maybe you have the responsibility to do updates, et cetera. And so the FTC is really trying to provide advice and commentary about how, you know, really these issues should be addressed.
Can you do a little dot connecting for us? I mean, I'm sure there are still listeners out there who are thinking, you know, who wants to hack my toaster or my thermostat or my light switch? What are the risks when you have an internet-enabled device, no matter how innocuous that device is?
Well, I think one of the best ways to understand the risks of IoT devices are, I mean, if you think about a virus or a disease spreading, when you connect to the internet and you have these devices, whether you bring them into your business or you bring them into your home, it allows someone to potentially come in and infect and get access to your data in many new ways than we used to see before. And, you know, sometimes hackers just want to do it because they just want to prove to the world that they're able to hack this device. I mean, that's one of the things in those big conferences that I mentioned. You know, companies will be sitting in there, and some of it is just security researchers proving that it can be done. But, you know, we worry about things such as medical devices and other things. You know, if someone can hack into, you know, a heart monitor or change dosing instructions and things like that, and, you know, it is possible. We know there's many cases that are out there of hackers being able to do, and it's just a reality. It's just another way to get in and affect a company's or a consumer's systems.
Right. This is akin to thinking about how, you know, a city's water supply might be maintained or electrical supply, right?
Exactly. And, you know, utility companies rely on lots of IoT devices as well.
And moreover, when it comes to home consumer devices, it sounds a little bit like, you know, the equivalent of leaving your back door open.
Very true. Very true. I mean, you need to – I always laugh, and we were talking about this earlier, like with great power comes great responsibility. When – I think this is a Spider-Man quote. When companies develop devices like this, I mean, they have the ability to do so many of amazing things, but manufacturers have the responsibility to think about, you know, the security measures that are in place, and consumers of which purchase these devices also need to take responsibility about understanding what that device does and what type of risk. I mean, there have been cases in the past. A lot of the FTC cases have involved, you know, in-home cameras, you know, that have been hacked where someone can view someone in their home, baby monitors, routers, you know, internet, you know, enabled TVs, you know, those types of things. So I think consumers need to understand when they bring that device into the home that they do have risk.
I know there are people who, you know, put just a simple piece of black tape over their over the camera lens on their smartphone or their laptop when they're not using it.
Number one thing to do, and I will tell you, you know, the FBI here comes out and does a lot of presentations. The number one thing you should do is on the camera on your laptop or anything like that, you know, is to put a cover on that camera phone, because that's one of the first things that, you know, hackers will look into doing.
As someone who specializes in this field, do you think twice or think more closely about which devices you want that have internet connectivity?
Most definitely.
I gather you took off the your fitness watch before you came over.
Yes, but I mean, I think about it. You know, when you know you enable a device to connect in, whether that's to, you know, your internet, you know, enabled watch, et cetera, you can often turn off settings of, you know, sending information back to the company. And so those are the things that I look at.
Well, and I gather things like fitness watches, you know, the Fitbit that I have on or whatever brand people have, many of them just have a Bluetooth signal that is on all the time and, you know, sends out location data to whoever is tracking such things.
Exactly. So does your phone, so do maps that follow you. And I just don't think the consumer awareness is really there. And I don't think consumers understand about how much information is being gathered about them on a daily basis, location data, health data, buying, you know, purchasing data, et cetera.
Well, these are all topics that we could get into the next time we chat. Jen Rathburn, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jen Rathburn is a partner at Foley & Lardner and co-founder of the Midwest Cybersecurity Alliance. You can find links to more resources and information about cybersecurity and the Internet of Things at WUWN.com.
An update on a large-scale effort to improve the health of people in one Wisconsin county when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio.
Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Back in January, we featured an interview with the leaders of an ambitious effort to improve the health of people living in Dodge County. The Blue Zones Project takes a page from the example set by people who live in places with the longest life expectancy in the world and looks at how those practices can be put into place here.
The Dodge County effort is the first of its kind in Wisconsin, and while its partners are people, organizations, and businesses across the community, it's spearheaded at Beaver Dam Community Hospitals. Lake Effect's Bonnie North got an update on the progress of the Dodge County Blue Zones from President and CEO Kim Miller, project leader Linda Klinger, and Mel Bruins, Chief Talent Officer at Beaver Dam Community Hospitals. And they talked about some of the specific health issues the Blue Zone project set out to address.
The idea behind the Blue Zones project started back in 2013 when we got to take a look at some health statistics of Dodge County and realized that we had an opportunity to make a change. So we started a coalition with the help of Kim that got a lot of members in the community together to really start implementing some change regarding the health of the community. From there, we brought in the Blue Zones Project.
Okay, so what were some of the health issues that you were seeing that you wanted to correct?
One of the statistics was we had, through the survey process, identified that 30% of the population admitted to binge drinking. We also had a very large percentage that was obese. There was inactivity, so they were stating that they weren't getting out and moving and having exercise. And with that obesity, we also have a large population who have diabetes.
So about, 20% of the population of Dodge County are smokers.
So we're looking at some pretty serious health issues or things that could lead to some serious health outcomes.
Yes, and when you look at the items that we mentioned to you, they're all very easy to prevent by making some few minor changes.
So what does the Blue Zones Project do to help people make those changes? If they're that easy to make, why weren't they being made before?
Blue Zones works to change the environment that we live in. When we set out to make a change on our own, the only tool that we've got is our own willpower. But when we combine that with a supportive environment where healthy choices surround us every day, where we work, where we play, where we go to church, where we shop for our groceries, where we go out to eat with our families, it makes that healthy choice the easier choice.
What have the outcomes been so far? This started last fall, is that correct?
Correct. We have actually kicked off the event. We have chosen four communities that we want to focus on: Beaver Dam, Horicon, Juneau, and Mayville. We had kickoff events in each of those communities where we had a very large exhibit with many members of the community coming in and learning more about Blue Zones. We are now working on some built environment initiatives. We're also working on policy initiatives. And then whenever Linda was speaking specifically about trying to make it easier for individuals, we're working with grocery stores and restaurants, and we have done workshops on purpose. We have formed MOIs, so groups of people coming together who are interested in something that they have in common, whether it's a walking MOI, so they want to move more during the day or during the week. They're coming together, and that also provides a different social environment for them. So we have seen some significant positive movement forward. We will be in Dodge County the first community in the nation to have hosted an alcohol summit. And that's obviously specific to the fact that we had an area around that we could make some improvements. But we were really pleased that Blue Zones worked with us to initiate that particular portion of the project.
So they're able to focus on community-specific needs, not just a blanket approach.
Right. They have research-based initiatives, but for the alcohol summit that we held, they brought in experts from the University of Minnesota, and they actually have been guiding our work in that area. So they are definitely tailoring it to some of the needs that we have.
So one of the keystones of this project is the community partnerships piece of it, the fact that it's not just the hospitals that are doing this, that there's lots of other businesses and groups that are participating. Are you finding that they're spearheading things in a way that you might not, Kim? Are you finding out interesting things from restaurants, say, or from other businesses?
Well, I think I want to comment on one thing that you said, because you're spot on. If the hospital would be the only one initiating this, it could not be as successful as it will be by having all of those communities involved, engaged, and citizens within those communities very, very excited about this initiative. So we're seeing that happen across all of the communities. We're seeing people come together, people who didn't even know that they had common interests before, but through this process have learned that they do. And people who are really fired up about making positive changes and seeing the communities all change. From the standpoint of restaurants, the first restaurant that was certified as a Blue Zones restaurant was NOLA in Mayville. The second restaurant to be certified was the BBCH Cafe. So the Hospital Cafe has become the second certified restaurant.
That's very cool. And what does certification mean, that they're serving healthy foods?
Yeah, that they have healthier options available for people who would like them. They've removed sugar-sweetened beverages from the cafeteria as well. And having a lot of vegetarian options so that people can really follow a plant-based diet if they choose to.
One of the things that was interesting is we had failed to make some of those changes in our physician's lounge, and one of the physicians brought that forward and said, could you also make the changes in our lounge? And so we've done that since that time.
That's also interesting. I mean, did you face any skepticism when this first started? And if so, has that diminished at all?
There was some, yes. I think that's always the case when you start something new, because you have to prove that it is going to work. But there was enough positive momentum. And Linda had mentioned the Healthy Communities, Healthy Lives Committee that we had started really 2 years prior to bringing Blue Zones in. And I think that was the foundation, because that group started with 20 people from across the county, and it grew to about 80. And now that number, because we have actually sunset that committee structure, and we have rolled all of those committee members who are interested in continuing into one of the structures within Blue Zones. But that has grown tremendously since that time. So I think it's like anything else. You have to start small and have people learn. And as they do, then they bring more people into the process. And that's what's happened.
So do you have any specific numbers at hand right now where you can point to examples of how those improvements have happened, where they've happened?
The Blue Zones Project partners with Gallup for a community survey that gives us a well-being index, and that's one of the benchmarks of the program and its success. That survey will be completed yet this year. That'll show us, and we'll complete that on a yearly basis. So we don't yet have any data to show what kind of progress we've made since implementing.
But empirically, you can see that there have been improvements.
Yeah,
absolutely. And one of the things I didn't mention when you were talking about restaurants is how we're working with grocery stores, because I think we've all had experiences where we've gone through the grocery checkout line and maybe picked something up that later we regretted picking up, like a candy bar or a bag of chips or a cookie or something that we didn't really want, but we were there. With Blue Zones, one of the things that they do is they have Blue Zones friendly lines. And so if you go through that line, you will be assured that it will be fruit. There will not be soda in that line. There will be water and flavored water. And so people have a choice. You can either go through the regular line or go through the line that's a Blue Zones friendly line.
I was going to say, if you're feeling like you need a little extra support that day, you can go through the Blue Zones friendly line.
Exactly.
These steps
small children. You know, you want them to be surrounded by positive choices. Really, they can't go wrong with any of the options that they select there. So it really helps them understand what's at arm's length that would be, you know, a good choice for them as well.
So what advice would you give to other communities that are looking to emulate what you're doing in Dodge County? Are there specific things that you would say, do this, don't do this?
I think it's really about finding the stakeholders in your community, the people who are excited to create a change and understand the importance of creating change, and really mobilizing those people into one project. I think every community has people who are interested in making a change, but it's not until you get all of those people together that you really start to get some traction.
Kim?
The one thing I would say is it's critical to go grassroots and get people from across the entire community actively engaged. Because what we have found is that people have connections, and as you're working on a project or they are working on a project, they can identify, oh, this person would be good to help us. And as that happens, you start reaching out even further. And that's exactly what we need for the success of the project. We did not mention, but I think this is a critical factor, we have all of the schools in those communities actively engaged. The school superintendents are sitting on our steering committee meetings. We have the mayors of those communities actively engaged. Other elected officials, our district attorney is very active on our committee structure. So we have a lot of very positive individuals who want to see this county have a healthier lifestyle.
Has this initiative affected any of you personally? Have you changed behaviors because of what you've learned through doing this?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of what we've learned that we've really implemented in the workplace that I think has impacted us, you know, both professionally and personally. And as we look at the opportunities that we have to really deploy those down to the people around us and the family members that we love, I mean, for me personally, I think the awareness to get out and just be active throughout the day. We all have pretty sedentary jobs at times. And so making sure that we, you know, make time in our lives to just disconnect from our technology and just go focus and be centered for a minute, and you just become so much more productive when you come back with a fresh lens and perspective.
I think that kind of rises to something that we definitely wanted to make sure we talked with you about, and that is the work that we have done within our own organization. Because we have worked very hard from the beginning, and we actually started the work here prior to officially implementing the Blue Zones project. And part of that discussion with our employees was that because we are the health center and because people look to us for advice, we need to be role modeling what we are going to be teaching and what we're going to be talking with others about. And so we've had a tremendous positive response from our employees. And Mel can talk a little bit about some of the things we've done, but we really have made changes there.
Yeah, so our employee wellness program is really a cross-functional effort with employees at all levels throughout the organization. And we've broken that out into different spheres of emphasis. So we have folks who really are passionate about movement and activity, and so they have a subcommittee. We have others who are really focused on nutrition and that type of health, and so they've formed another group. And then the third group is sustaining inner balance. And that's all about caring about an employee's emotional and mental well-being. And so what we have done is kind of structured those groups and empowered them to come up with different programming and content throughout the year that's driven by our employees who participate in an annual survey to tell us what they're in need of and what they really want to help them support and reach any goals that they might have in either of those categories. So across the organization, we've done a variety of different things, such as offering wellness movement classes on site. So we offer Zumba and yoga and Tai Chi, some of the things that we do throughout the year. On the nutritional front, we've formed a partnership and now offer a CSA drop-off. We have healthy cooking classes, so our employees can really learn how to take those habits home and make healthy eating a fun thing for their families as well.
personal finance.
And so in our sustaining inner balance, we've done some focus this year on people's financial health, because that can really cause a lot of stress and anxiety. And so we've been hosting some educational classes around finances and how employees can, you know, set goals to help reach whatever aspirations they may be at in their life at this moment. As well as we do some meditation classes around the holidays to really help people de-stress and focus on the things that really matter, which, you know, includes just taking time for yourself around such a chaotic, kind of crazy time of the year.
So it sounds like it's a case of physician heal thyself first and then take it out into the community.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I hope that you will join us again in another 6 to 9 months. So once we get that report in, it would be wonderful to see if the results you actually get echo what you really think you're going to get. And it sounds like it will, but it'll be fun to see the numbers.
Well, thank you so much. We would love to do that.
Kim Miller is president and CEO of Beaver Dam Community Hospitals. Mel Bruins is chief talent officer. And Linda Klinger is project leader there for the Dodge County Blue Zones effort. They spoke with Bonnie North, and you can learn more about the project at WUWM.com.
Another break now, and then we'll meet two people closely involved with an innovative urban beekeeping project here in Milwaukee. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Growing food doesn't always occur in the country. From city-based commercial operations like Growing Power to personal backyard or even balcony urban vegetable gardens, urban agriculture in Wisconsin's largest city is booming. But no matter where they are, the one thing all gardens have in common is the need for pollination.
And when we think of pollination, most of us think of honeybees. The rooftop of Redeemer Lutheran Church on 19th in Wisconsin is host to three flourishing hives. Until recently, Maggie Stang was one of the people who helps maintain them. Stang joined Lake Effect's Bonnie North in the studio earlier this summer and explained how she became an apiarist.
I just graduated from Marquette University, and during my time at Marquette, I helped out at a meal program at a church called Redeemer Lutheran Church on 19th in Wisconsin, and we have a lunch meal program most days of the week for anybody in the neighborhood who needs a warm lunch. One day, I was there finishing up, cleaning up with some of the other students, and the pastor there, Pastor Lisa, said to me, "Do you want to come meet the bees on the roof?" I was like, "What are you talking about?" And so we went up to the roof, and there I saw a beehive, and I met a beekeeper named Charlie. And he was speaking about the bees in such wonderful, mystical terms and explaining the ways that they pollinate our neighborhood. And really, from that moment on, I was absolutely hooked.
Did you know anything about bees before that?
I knew the minor stuff that most people know that they're important for pollination. But then I didn't know the extent to which they were so important, and also how just amazing they are and their communities are. And then I heard a few months later that the church was hoping to get some of the meal program guests involved in the beekeeping on the roof. And that's when I knew that it was something that I needed to be involved in, because I really loved that meal program and had gotten to know a lot of people there.
So this is agriculture and social justice all rolled into one.
Yeah, we definitely try to keep it community oriented as much as about bees.
So you have a couple of hives up on the roof. How much honey does that produce?
So we have three hives on the roof, and each hive is a different type of hive. So one is called a top bar hive, which is best for educational purposes, produces a little bit less honey versus a Langstroth box hive. It's kind of what you picture, you know, those white boxes stacked on top of each other, people in bee suits.
And then you lift up.
You lift up those and put another one underneath, and mm-hmm. those can produce, you know, gosh, a given year up to, you know, 100, you know, pounds of honey, more or less. Kind of depends where you are and what the year looks like. So we do jar and sell that honey out of the church, but a lot of our work focuses on the community education aspect.
So how are people reacting? I mean, most people think of bees as things to stay away from.
Right.
You know, particularly if they've grown up in a city, you don't want to be stung and you think this is just some insect that's going to hurt me.
Definitely. And I think that a big part of it is what we do is we try to explain the situation. We kind of explain to people that, given our current agricultural system, where the bees are out in our fields where we practice agriculture, it's actually harmful for them. For a variety of reasons, the bees are dying and they're being weakened. And so in reality, even though you wouldn't assume it, our urban areas and our cities have more biodiversity and are more abundant and offer a more diverse diet for the bees than you'd think. So when we practice urban beekeeping, we're creating healthier bees and allowing people to have a better idea of where their food comes from and kind of think about, you know, is my food local? Where am I getting that from? Is my food as healthy as I think it is? And kind of brings people together around those conversations as well. So we try to explain kind of holistically the whole situation and kind of lure people up to the roof to say, you got to meet them. You know, they're not going to bug you. They're actually defensive. And unless they feel threatened, they might throw you a sting, but usually not. And when we describe to people that it's an issue that involves every single one of us, we all eat, we all value our fruits and veggies, then people feel kind of immediately included. And when I explain, you know, how magical they are, they kind of get a little sense of curiosity, and overcoming that fear on the roof is something that's really special to witness.
Talk a little bit about that magic. What makes them magical?
Gosh, there are so many things that make bee communities magical. So there are a lot of working parts. Most people are familiar with the queen bee, and they think that she kind of runs the whole show. But it's really about everybody working together. And while the queen does lay all of the eggs, it's all about what the worker bees are doing. So, I mean, it's hard for me to think of another community, another species that creates their own home and their own food and also has a symbiotic, mutually beneficial relationship with basically everything around it. So not only is it creating that fruit so that we can eat it, but they're going home and creating their own food from that pollen, and they're creating their own homes from that pollen and that nectar. And they're incredibly resourceful. They're not wasteful. Every bee has a place in the hive. Every bee does its job to its full extent. And I think that's just something you don't see that often. And I think being able to see that helps us think about, you know, how can our communities be more resourceful? How can our communities be more community-oriented in the way that everybody has a place, everybody has a voice, everybody is cared for in a greater way? And so that's been really inspirational for us, is how can we learn from the little bits and the little specific things bees do to help each other be more community-oriented.
Now, is there a particular type of honeybee that you're working with, or are there different species of bees that help pollinate?
Yeah, there are lots of different species of bees. We're working with the honeybees specifically in our hives, but you'll also see, you know, bumblebees are those fuzzy, larger ones that kind of bumble around, and they really are solitary, so less community-oriented. There are carpenter bees that you'll see, other ones as well. And then, of course, people always associate the wasps and the hornets, which also live a little bit differently, and they create their nests out of different things like paper and not.
But are they
wax.
Pollinators as well?
Yeah, especially the bumblebees and carpenter bees. And yeah, they definitely play their part. But the honeybees are responsible for up to a third of what we eat. Usually is what we say, you know, one every three bites that you eat was probably pollinated by a honeybee.
So I understand, you know, you said you graduated.
Yeah.
And you're going off to Minneapolis in the fall. Is that correct?
Well, I'm from Minneapolis, just graduated from Marquette. And in the beginning of August, I'll be going out to Tacoma, Washington. And I'm doing a year with the Jesuit Volunteer Corps. I have an AmeriCorps position, and I'll be working out there. And one amazing thing is that there's a church down the road from where I live that has a bee project. So I think there was a little bit of fate involved there.
A little synergy happening.
Yeah, so I'm excited about that.
Do you hope to continue with apiary studies?
Yes, absolutely. I think that bees are a really amazing unifier for people, and that when you think about how we all are connected to the plight and cause of bees, you can really bring together some different perspectives that aren't usually in the same room. You know, whether it's a beekeeper who's been beekeeping for 15 years, or a college student, or somebody who just got, you know, just got housing after being homeless for 5 years, or a kid from down the street. You know, when you're all on the roof and looking at bees, we're all learning together, and we're all thinking more seriously about our part in our environment and in our city. So I think that it's something that I can stay involved in wherever I am,
Are you hoping that the people that you work with here, that they'll take up urban beekeeping?
Yes. So, I mean, the great thing about urban beekeeping is that there's a spectrum of involvement. Maybe you just want to be someone who has a small victory garden and you're more conscious of what you plant. Or maybe you want to help out, you know, on the roof of the church down the street and you want to learn a little bit more about bees before you get your own hive. Or maybe you're ready to jump right in and get a hive and take care of it. So there's a range, and we find that people kind of inch closer and closer. And then when they do get that hive, we like to help them out and make sure that it's thriving.
Say I decide I have a little patio on my backyard and I've got some trees and there are certainly birds around and I've seen butterflies and that sort of thing. How do I set up a little hive, both for myself if I want to harvest the honey, but also to make sure that the bees are healthy?
Sure. There are a variety of people in the city, like, for example, Charlie, the beekeeper I work with.
Charlie Keenan?
Yes, Charlie Keenan. Mm-hmm. He could help you get set up with a hive. It'd be a specific type of hive, like you said, based on what you want. If you were more focused on, you know, a little bit of honey and pollination for your neighborhood, he'd probably set you up with a top bar hive. He'd position it in a good spot for you that's considerate of where the bees come and go. And beyond that, this is what Charlie would say, is being a beekeeper is about being a pattern recognitionist. And so what you generally do is you're trying your best to let the bees be and do what they do, because they know it better than we do. And then you're taking note of what's going on inside the hive so that you can help them do their job better. So when you're looking through, you're noting, you know, where are the baby bees and where are they storing honey and where are they bringing in pollen and is it getting a little bit crowded in the hive and do you need to add a bar or two so they can grow out to avoid a, you know, a swarm in your neighborhood, to have your neighbor call on you. That's the kind of thing that creates healthy bees and creates a nice little supply of honey for you and your neighbors at the end of the season.
So if people want to come to the church and see the hives that are there, can they just show up or come for lunch, that sort of thing?
Yeah, I would say come for lunch, or, you know, on Sundays we try to do, you know, after church and after lunch, sometimes we bring groups up for tours. You know, feel free to drop us a note too. You know, today we had a group of 27-year-olds from another church up the street, and, you know, the next day we might have a group, you know, of 10, you know, elderly people from down the road. So we're really open to anybody who wants to come see the bees, as long as they've got a curiosity.
Well, I am so happy that we were able to get in touch and get you in here to talk about this. Thank you so much, Maggie.
Of
I appreciate
course.
It.
Thank you.
Maggie Stang graduated this spring from Marquette University and headed west to Tacoma, Washington, where she'll spend the next year as an AmeriCorps volunteer.
As we heard, Maggie Stang not only became an avid apiarist, but also shared her passion with homeless men and women who take meals at Redeemer Lutheran Church. Lake Effect Susan Benz picks up the story on the church's rooftop with Stang's mentor, Charlie Keenan.
Bees first began to creep into Charlie Keenan's life in 2002. Today, his previous careers in computer programming and consulting might as well belong to someone else altogether. Keenan is a bee evangelist through and through.
Yeah, I never would have predicted the path. Couldn't have predicted it in a million years. But really, the importance is just how astonishing the inside of a beehive when it's operating is. And the amazement that it brought me, and the amazement I can bring others when I can get them, as the man who brought me first to the hive did, to put down my defenses, to back off of my fear. So when I came to the hive and I saw it, it was amazing. And that's the amazement that I want to give to everybody, is take a look inside, see that they're not only safe, but they're amazing.
In 2009, he invented a beehive called the Bee Pod. Keenan says the system works with bees naturally by spreading the colony out sideways rather than up, as it would be in traditional stacked boxes. His aim was to use the system to educate people about bees. The Bee Pod is one of three different systems atop Redeemer Lutheran Church's small rooftop terrace.
This one over here is a new invention in the bee business called a flow hive. And so we're test driving this one. It has a special invention inside of the upper box that allows us to open it up and pour honey into jars in the back.
Hi, Charlie, I heard all about you. Oh,
as if on cue, a visitor appears. Susan Martin lives in Toledo, Ohio now, but her husband was pastor here back in the 1970s. She's fascinated by the bees, but fearful at the same time.
I love it. I just love this. So I'm not going to be stung, right? Because I'm really allergic.
Nope. Everything's safe up here.
Okay. So but what, they're all over the place, so I'm a little freaked out.
Yep, three different hives. Don't worry. Just be a tree.
just be a tree. Yeah. Still?
Stand still.
All right.
And nobody will mind.
Do you mind if I take pictures?
Yeah, you can take pictures.
I want to take this back to my church at home and inspire them.
Although he would like to ensure the future of honeybees everywhere, Keenan says he's learned something amazing about how well honeybees can do in urban settings.
Right now, with monoculture agriculture as widespread as it is, it's just bad for the bees' diet. Having one type of food in a massive amount is great for business, but it isn't very good for the bee. So if we can leave the bees in the city where they have abundance, look at on our rooftop, we've got all kinds of different things here, but then look 2 miles out from here, there's so much variety and different types of things. And then even extraordinarily more than that, in the inner city, there are less people pouring chemicals on things. There's less Chemlawn. So my hives that are inside of the city are the best hives I have, the most thriving hives. If that's not an example that some of the things that we're doing out in the fields where they're dying isn't working, I don't know what is. But it's important for us to save and preserve bee genetics and bees to know the old way when winter came and when seasons changed, not to get loaded up on a truck and driven to California or Florida to keep on working all year round. That's the reason why we've got bees in the city.
Over time, Keenan has partnered with groups, including Cor El Centro, in the Walker's Point neighborhood to nurture hives on its rooftop garden. Various Milwaukee County Park golf courses, and Marquette University. It recently installed a pod atop its state-of-the-art engineering building.
Charlie, this pepper's ready to go, don't you think? Totally. Come take a look.
Pastor Lisa Bates Froyland pops up before Sunday service to pluck Redeemer Lutheran's first piece of produce, a plump pepper.
It's going to go down to the kitchen, but first I'm going to show the congregation at the beginning of worship, and then I'll have a kid run it down to the kitchen.
It would be incorporated into the meal served up to those who might otherwise not eat. Bates Froyland says before the bees, there was no life on this rooftop. Now there are pots of flowers, vegetables, and herbs growing.
This is life and abundance and hope. And especially in a little piece of the city that sometimes seemed dry and tired and past its prime. So we're saying, I think things are cycling back and it's time for a renaissance, even here at 19th and Wisconsin Avenue.
And the bee symbolism doesn't stop there. As their service ends, Bates Froyland leads a procession out and around to the church's back lot, where she's about to bless an artist at work. Parishioner Dave Rothy joins in the line.
The bees, they've really brought a special aspect to our whole congregation. It's a group effort, and it's something so different and unique, you know what I mean? And it kind of, in its own way, brings life. In its odd way to the church.
Fascinating, isn't it?
Isn't it?
Oh, have you spent time up there?
Yeah.
So you're not afraid of the bees?
No. I'm a gardener.
Local artist Adam Nilsson is creating more public excitement on the church's south-facing wall that had for decades been a crumbling eyesore. Appropriately, Nilsson is painting a giant bee mural.
We came up with the design just by utilizing the age and distressed look of the wall, and we're going to use that to our advantage, and it's going to make sense visually. And it's such high visibility in the Marquette area. There's so many people that see this. I really, truly want to give it my full effort and make it the best piece I've ever done.
A large honeycomb-filled cross has already taken shape. Nilsson's son, Jackson, is here to assist him.
It's very amazing to see how an old, worn-down wall has turned into a masterpiece like this.
It's hard to tell who is the prouder Nilsson, son or father.
This is a big summer for him. This is the first summer that he's by my side on job sites. Hopefully every summer, when he's done with school, he'll have work and he'll know what to do.
Sounds like a couple of good worker bees to me. For Lake Effect, I'm Susan Bentz.
Beevangelist founder Charlie Keenan can often be found at Redeemer Lutheran Church's rooftop apiary at 19th and Wisconsin Avenue here in Milwaukee. This evening, Bees for Change is the focus of an event at the Zeidler Center for Public Discussion, and you can learn more about the honey-themed dinner and dialogue from a link at WUWM.com.
Do you remember your first car? Of course you do. It's been a while since Lake Effect essayist Jim Spangler bought his first car, but it is an event and a car that still occupies an important place in his memory.
With the car show season in full swing a few weeks ago, what could possibly upstage this admitted old car fan from attending the best car show in Milwaukee, you ask? Tickets to the same Sunday's matinee performance of Hamilton in Chicago, my wife answered. There'll always be next year's car show, and when I go, I'll spend most of my time with cars from the 50s. What's so special about cars from that era, you ask? Let me explain. Ah, the 50s. Eisenhower was in the White House and Elvis was in the Army. And me, in that glorious fall of 1958, Dad and I were car shopping for his first ever new car. What more could any 16-year-old boy want? Visiting the dealerships, slamming doors, kicking tires, and looking under the hoods of Fords, Plymouths, and Chevys, all the time pretending to know what I was doing. I was sorry it had to end, but Dad finally settled on a two-door, three-tone blue Ford. I'd have to wait 3 long years before I started car shopping again. But this time it would be for my car, my very own car with the money from my newspaper truck route. Another difference. I started driving company newspaper trucks 2 weeks after my 16th birthday. What would company lawyers say about that today? Given the 3-year anticipation before buying my first car, can you imagine the excitement when in the fall of 1961, it was actually time to buy my own, my very own first car? There may be a person of my vintage somewhere who has forgotten about their first car, but I doubt it. Now let me tell you about mine. It was a 1955 Buick Special blue and white two-door with a thundering V8 engine coupled with a slower-than-molasses Dynaflow automatic transmission. I paid the staggering sum of $800 for the car. I thought it was a steal. Dad thought I'd been had, and as it turned out, we were both about half right. Every used car of that era had some idiosyncrasies, and my Buick was no exception. Pushing in the cigarette lighter blew a fuse, and all the dash lights went out, and the radio died. Not that the radio was much by today's standards. My SUV, a black box SUV that looks like everybody else's black box SUV, has speakers all over the place. This Buick had one tiny speaker in the middle of the dashboard. But who cared about dash lights and radios? I had my own car, my own set of wheels to take me anywhere I wanted to go, providing I had a buck for 4 gallons of gas. Years pass, things change, even those things we don't want to change. I can't remember the last time I saw a 55 Buick on the road. But for those of my general age bracket, somewhere in the corners of our imagination and in the hollows of our memory, we can still drive our first car. I can see that blue and white Buick sitting in the driveway, freshly washed. It's calling me to go somewhere with its full tank of gas, a rarity in those days. Do I drive around the block, pick up Tom, and head to Rostrelli's for a taste of the best pizza in town? The spicy sausage and mushrooms, please, along with a Coke, a real Coke made with syrup and sparkling water. Or can I find the courage to ask her out? This girl I just ran into the other day. She seemed kind of interested, but a guy, well, a guy never really knows for sure. Thank you, Detroit, for giving me my 55 Buick Special blue and white two-door. For what started out as just a car, now for this old man, has become a time machine. A time machine with 4 wheels, a dead radio, and no dash lights. And did the girl say yes? I was going to tell you, but a guy should have some secrets.
Lake Effect essayist Jim Spangler is a retired newspaperman who now lives in Brookfield. And that's the Tuesday edition of the show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for tuning in today. And I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from listener-supported 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
It's 11 o'clock, so stay tuned. Fresh air is next.
I'm coming for you. I'm coming for you. I'm coming for you.